Good evening, everyone. And welcome to this evening's lecture. It's a very special opportunity that we have. I'd like to start by thanking Rabbi Rosenbaum and Yom Gezel Shomrei Emunah for being such a wonderful partner and host with us in general, and in particular tonight. Office staff, Mr. Rosenberg, for all his efforts. I'd like to thank Rabbi Zakum, on behalf of the Kollel, for making it possible, and all the efforts that he put in. Take the opportunity to invite everybody to the Kollel's Chanukah Mesiva, and next week there are flyers in the chair. It should be a very special and beautiful event. Be having Shlomo Hurwitz doing a special theater performance on the Israeli attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor and the lessons that we see from that, Hanukkah lessons, as well as a magic show for children and delicious food and the band and dancing. So you're all welcome to join us. That will be at the Kollel and 10900 Lockwood Drive in White Oak. And as well, feel free to contact Rabbi Zakum about the theme of tonight's lecture, about reaching out if you'd like to know about opportunities and resources both that the Kollel provide and as well other organizations. Tonight we have a special lecturer, somebody all the way from Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Mati Berger was born here in the United States, and has been a senior lecturer on Jewish philosophy and contemporary Jewish issues for Eshet Torah for almost three decades. Before that, he founded an organization that's well known to us. It's called Jews for Judaism in Baltimore, Maryland, to deal with the problem of Christian missionary activity aimed at Jews. Somebody incidentally just told me that there's a big Jews for J Center that's opening in Rachman, so all our efforts to counter missionary activities are to be for good use over here locally. Rabbi Berger was born in Cleveland and lived for 17 years in Baltimore before moving to Israel with his family in 1985. He received smicha from Neri Yisrael as well as a BA from Loyola University of Baltimore. Rabbi Berger has spoken to a wide range of audiences in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, South America, South Africa, and Australia. Seems like the theme here is English-speaking countries. He is frequently invited to address students at yeshivas and seminaries in Israel and has been featured speaker at many Shabbatonim, sponsored by synagogues and Jewish educational outreach institutions in the U.S. and abroad. Rabbi Berger speaks on a broad range of topics, from theoretical Jewish philosophy to the practical present-day concerns of contemporary Jewish life. He is much admired for his ability to make Jewish ideas and philosophy both understandable and relevant to modern Jews of all backgrounds. Rabbi Berger has been a pioneer of many initiatives and ideas of reaching out to the non-observant. Those of us today who are engaged in reaching out to our fellow brothers and sisters are indebted to Rabbi Berger for his pioneering efforts, creating a blueprint for us. It's my great honor to call on Rabbi Berger to address us tonight.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Winston.
Great.
So it's a Haimisha Oilam. Yeah, now, Baltimore. Baltimore faculty twins. Yeah, Baltimore. I mean, same thing, no? Yeah, it was a joke back then, too. So, look, I'd like to talk relatively briefly both about theoretics and when it comes to outreach and making a difference to other people, talk about the ideas and then some practical suggestions, practical applications, and after my speaking briefly, I'm going to stick around for as long as possible. Questions, discussion. Um, Back, let's see, when I started, 3 decades, did you say?
Yeah.
So it's true, I'm too young for that. I'm on my 30th year at Eishet Torah in Israel. And Rabbi Noach Weinberg always said, we're not going to be able to make a difference one by one, professionals teaching Torah. What's going to be the difference is the Jewish people taking responsibility for making a difference to others. Of course, the number one question is how? How do you make a difference? So first I'd like to talk about, mentioned in the flyer, who are we and who are they? First, theoretically, and then practical application. So, on the simple scale, you look at the Jewish world. Jewish world is approximately 15% of the Jewish world is referred to itself as Orthodox. What is the largest subdivision of Jewish people? Orthodox, Serbophone. What's the biggest subdivision? Very good. They used to not know that. Unaffiliated. The none of the above. The good news is that to them, and if there's Reform, there's Orthodox, to find out something about Judaism. The bad news is that the unaffiliated is generally the last one or two generations of those particular families before they disappear. You have a world where we are considered an equal part of the white population. When it comes to minorities, they almost don't even think about us. And we don't want to wish anything bad on ourselves. That's the way that this country is a place where if you want, you can be as Torah observant as you want, and the Gentiles will protect you to do it. And then you can be as drop out as much as you want, and they'll protect you. So what we need is reasons for people making a connection. So first, let's look at who we are. In its simple form, there's Orthodox Jews who accept the concept that there's a God who created the universe, transmitted the Torah to the Jewish people as the information of how to be Jewish. That's one way of looking at it. Or another thing, God transmitted the Torah to the Jewish people to tell us how to be ideal human beings. You know, people talk about the Jewish religion, actually. Torah doesn't talk about religion. Torah talks about we are mamlechas, a kingdom of priests, and we're here to change humanity. And while we're talking about speaking to our fellow Jews, it's really important to understand that Judaism was given to change humanity. Give an example, run into at Eishet Torah. Person says, look, there are a lot of ideas in Judaism, they're very fine, but they, you know, everybody's accepted them already. Don't kill, don't steal, be nice to people. Isn't it obvious that when we talk about things, you don't have to be Jewish to learn that information? We would say that, first of all, theoretically, you go back 2,000 years to the time of the Roman Empire. And part of the sports scene was going to the Colosseum to watch people kill each other. It's not merely that the world had no problem with killing people for fun. It's that you need a reason for any moral aspect. It's not just it's not done. You need a reason for a right and a wrong. And the world that didn't have that may have looked like they changed, but then you get to the 20th century and catching Jewish babies on their bayonets becomes perfectly okay as well. The world became, at its best, the world became what it is based on Torah, and it's something that we should understand that we represent. 3,200 years ago, God transmitted the Torah to the Jewish people. How many Jews were there at the time? Anybody know? The answer is, I'm not sure either. We know there are 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, the kids under 20, people over 60, women, so 2 to 3 million. So 3,300 years ago, we had 2 to 3 million Israelites. And the truth is that historians would say that in the early temple period, you know, the first temple period, there were a few million Israelites in that territory. 2 million generally given. How many Jews, if those people maintain their Jewish identity as they are their children and grandchildren, how many Jews should there be in the world today? Not necessarily the same number. I've seen in the range of opinions, there should, the most conservative estimate I've seen is 250 million. Now remember, Chinese have a great advantage of being a racial identity, right? But that means that over time, the Jewish people multiply and also assimilate into the surrounding culture. It's important to understand that Torah talks about that when we misbehave or are driven in exile, we'll remain the fewest among all the nations. The real question is not why are we 250 million. The real question is, how is it that we survived in spite of not having any control of our environment? Let me lay out a basic theory for you to think about. And it requires not necessarily a Torah view of it, but an evolutionary view of being Jewish. Are we, as people, are we animals or human beings? What was that? What's your name, young man? Tom, I think I'll pick on you tonight. So we're both animals and human beings. Is that what you're saying? Okay, I'll accept that. Within the context of the idea, and was, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Darwin, and by the way, just to let you know that this is, I'm not taking a secular view of it, Charles Darwin tells us we're part of the animal kingdom. Modern science will tell you that there's less than a 1% difference between a higher mammal and a human being, genetically. Familiar with that? What does the Torah tell us? What does the Torah tell us, Tom, about being animals versus human beings?
Animal body and a godly soul.
In other words, the part you can see is animal, and the part you can't is more. All right. Because the Kohelet, in Tanakh, Kohelet says, Umotar adam mina behema oyin. The difference between an animal and a human being is zero. So when we look around the world, its acceptance of the Torah or its rejection is reflected by, really reflected in how we see ourselves. We're going to go back to a previous point and then come back to this to understand our understanding of what Torah and the difference of making a difference to other people. The rabbis tell us, Ramchal talks about it in Mesilat Yesharim, what is the most essential essence of any human being? This is important because a Torah Jew says, I am here to be an Eved Hashem. I am here to be a servant of God. And a secular guy, what does a secular guy say? I'm here to have a good time. Right? What did you say?
Pleasure.
I'm here to get pleasure. So what do we have in common with those people out there? I'm talking a secular Jew. We're here to be servants of God. He's here to have pleasure. We don't have much in common, do we? Oh, what is it? Very good. So the most important point is to understand. So Moshe Chaim Luzzatto points out in Mesilat Yesharim, first chapter, the essence of every human being, man was created for no other purpose but to get the maximum pleasure from the infinite source. one point for the secular guy. Right? He's saying, I want to get the most out of life. You guys tell me I should be a servant of God. The Ramchal comes out on the side of the secular guy. You were created to get pleasure. The guy says, I don't think it's the pleasure that I was talking about. So what's the next step? Think about yourself. You were created to get pleasure. What is the most important tool you need in order to get it? The most important tool you need. I want to get pleasure. We're sitting on the same side as the secular guy. We all want to get pleasure. What do we need most? Well, if you got it, fine. If not, too late. But I mean, a brain. Okay, well, you're here, and you're a person, and brain, and a bit of an education. I want pleasure. What do you need most? So that the decisions you make will result in pleasure. We're saying there's something more important to know. The rabbis say, the drive for emet, the drive to find out the truths of life, is not separated at all by the drive for pleasure. We live in a world where everybody wants to get pleasure. Picture, this is universal. I know this is going to be Jewish, particularly. Everybody was created to get, to maximize the pleasure they get out of life. The most important thing you need in order to get pleasure is emet. Finding out the truths of life. Go to a med school. Why are they spending billions of dollars to find out about medicine? Because we all know that the more you know the truths of about medicine, the more likely the decisions you are going to make result in pleasure. The more you ignore those truths, we live in order to understand those two elements that come together. Everybody wants pleasure. You have to understand, to get pleasure, you've got to find out the truths of life. Now, what's your name, young man? Yeah.
Craig.
Craig, do you want to get pleasure in life? Well, that doesn't sound as the central drive of your humanity. You want to get pleasure out of life?
Yeah.
Do you want to search for truth? That's the common. What's your name, young man?
Aaron.
Generally, that's the way it works. Hey, Fred, you want pleasure? Yeah. You want truth? Yeah. All right. So, what is it about us? Remember, because I'm going to want to pull this to understand that the secular guy is going to be much closer to the classical Jewish concept of what are we all doing here, while we, even as Orthodox Jews, we have our own inner problems with it. And really, we'll find that the things we do with them will be just as important for us as it is for them. That we're not here to serve them. We're really doing things, pulling ourselves together. And really, I find that people get involved in this. I certainly feel myself in my work at Eishet Torah, that I have gotten more from the work than anybody I've talked to, at least as much as them. Okay, so all right, I'm going to leave this up back to everybody. I want to pick on a bunch of guys over here. They're bigger than me. All right. So, we all want pleasure. We can't understand that to get pleasure, you've got to find out the truths of life. You get the idea? Abraham didn't know he was searching for God. All he knew is, I want to get the most out of life, and these guys in Babylonia are making terrible. They're not answering questions. I got to find out the truths of life. He's looking for, find out what's real. Are we making sense? It's really important to understand, therefore, that in a world where everybody wants pleasure, everybody can know that you should find out the truths of life, we're more interested in pleasure than we are in truth. Tom, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you this. I guess Tom can be your spokesman. I don't know if volunteers, though. Speak up. Take 7 billion human beings.
And everybody want, and all of them want pleasure. But there are two groups. Divide humanity into two groups. Group A says, I want pleasure, and to get it, I want to find out the truths of life. The second group says, I want pleasure, and the heck with truth. I mean, if it feels good, I'm going to do it. That's it. I want pleasure, and the heck with truth. Two groups. Can somebody give me the name of these two groups? Group A says, I want pleasure, and I'm searching for truth. B says, I want pleasure, and the heck with truth. Is it Jews versus Gentiles? No. Jews on both sides, Gentiles on both sides. Hold for a moment. Okay. How about, is it men and women?
Yeah.
Find out who said that. Or women and men. Anyway, now you're not going to get me into that one. So what are the two different groups in which everybody is in one of the two? Hedonists, humanists, Epicureans and non-Epicureans. I would posit that it's more basic. The difference between group A and group B, in group A are adults, group B is children. The adults are the ones that know that to get the most out of life, you've got to find out the truths of life. And the children who just said, if it tastes good, do it. I'm not interested in finding out what's true. Are we making sense, Tom? Very well. No, that's much rarer than the other one that you were about to say. That's where we're getting to. Tom, how old are you?
31.
Tom? I didn't ask her age. You know, that's what you got to ask her. 31. Okay, Tom, are you a child or an adult? Don't ask her. Are you a child or an adult? You're an adult. He's 31. At what age, according to the rabbis, at what age did you become an adult?
13.
Oh, so that's quite a little while ago. Okay, a little bit. Tom, and yet, when I ask you, do you want pleasure, you say, sure. Do you want truth? Yeah, I guess so. I would posit to you that I would disagree with your statement. What I would say, Tom, is that from 0 to 13, obviously goes right, or for women, 0 to 12, 0 to 13, you were a child. You wanted pleasure. Truth was irrelevant. It was so irrelevant that God himself did not hold you accountable for your lack of search for truth. God himself did not hold you accountable. But at 13, you became? Very good. In other words, you did not become an adult at 13, did you? I'm sorry, I'm not giving you that one either. At 13, you didn't become an adult, Tom. At 13, because this is going to be both us and them, our Jews, other Jews. At 13, you didn't become an adult. At 13, God activated an adult within you, Tom, but the child refused to leave. Right? And therefore, at 31, you are both. You are Tom and Tom Incorporated. And that's all of us. 0 to 13, you're a child. 13 to the day you die, you are Tom and Tom Incorporated. You're a 31-year-old child and a 18-year-old adult. Are we making sense? Does that actually grasp a little more of understanding about yourself? You're making sense? Every adult has the inner struggle between the adult and the child. And that's even without advertising. Right? In the same way, right? In the same way, Tom, I'm saying that it's not just Darwin. You are both animal and human beings. Let's look at it in Darwin's terms. You've been an animal for millions of years, Tom. For 5,775 years, you've been Adam, but at the time that you were Adam, it's not that you weren't animal. You are both. Tom, are you an individual or are you part of a group? You're both. Which are you more? Depends on who? Depends on situation. I say that's theoretically true, but I would posit to you that Tom, and this is part where we could feel most connected to people who are not raised observant, Tom is 99% group, part of the group, and 1% individual. Obviously, I don't know Tom. He just looks like a good sport. Less likely to hit me after this. So let's lay it out. Give me three examples. Tom, what you already told us, you're 31. What year were you born? 1983. What? Where were you born? Where were you born? Right here? Upstate New York. What's your last name? Treeblosser. There are three things about Tom. We're going to look at each very briefly. To understand that who Tom is massively the result of things beyond his control. Suppose Tom was born not in 1983, but in 1883. And this is 1914. Tom is 31. And suppose that God has seen to it that every atom of Tom's body as it is now is part of him at 31. Literally, atom by atom, the same neurons, etc. Right? Do you realize that you'd be a totally different person, Tom? Because the times you live in, it's not even subtle. It's so massively determinant of who you are. Do we hear that idea, ladies and gentlemen? Suppose you're born in 1983, but not in upstate New York, but in Pakistan. Tehran, Boise, Idaho, or really, you'd be crazy about it, Mea Shearim. You'd be a totally different person. You get it? You didn't determine the place. Suppose you're born in 1983 in upstate New York, but not to the Treeblossers, but to the Hernandezes, or the Hayakawas, the McCarthys, or frankly, even the Goldbergs, you know. Do you realize that you'd be a totally different person? So really, it's important for all of us to understand that who we are is so massively outside of ourselves. And we fully make decisions to figure out what we can know in a world where we want pleasure. How do we find out what's true? To understand that after all the learning we do about the importance of God in Torah, what makes most Torah observant Jews is choosing their grandparents well. And it shouldn't be so surprised to us, because we know what makes you Jewish is having chosen your parents well. That this strange combination of the things we didn't choose, and then the things that we do choose. Try to now look at the people outside of a Torah community and realize they could be so similar to you. So similar to you, except for the last few generations. How many generations has it been since we received the Torah? Anybody know? Tom, how many generations?
No, we don't have to cut off.
What? No, it's generally divided by 33. There's approximately, we generally see that there are three generations in a century. The average person has their children when they're 33. There's an amazingly common understanding, a solid. You know, if you're secular, you start having kids in your late 20s and you finish in your late 30s. If you're Haredi, you start when you're 18, 19, and until 50. But it's amazing how solid that 33 is. Do you understand what I mean? You know, for every Haredi guy who had their first kid when they were 18, they had another one when they're 48. And so 33 is an amazingly
three centuries and 3,300 years times three is 99. The average younger person is roughly at generation number 100 in the Jewish world. Now, you know, I do this in my classes sometimes. Take the most secular people we know. How far back do you have to go? How many generations back do we have to trace them back to the point that their families were Torah observant in what we now call Orthodox? Three, maybe four, the younger guys. Do you understand the commonality we have with them? Over the last 100 generations, and by the way, we don't even move by generation, because while we have 100 generations, how many generations does the average human being cover in communication with other generations? How many generations does the average person cover? Tom, did you ever have a conversation with your grandparents?
Yeah.
Grandparents? And your parents? And your friends? And God willing, your children and your grandchildren. In others, there's only 100 generations back to Sinai, and the average person covers 5 generations in his communication with other people. Good idea. In those terms, the difference between the most Torah observant Jew and the most secular Jew is that the Torah observant Jew says, I am part of the process of transmission of Torah for 100 generations. While the secular guy says, I have been part of a process of Torah for 96, but 1, 2, 3, or 4 generations ago, somebody in my family dropped it. That's the commonality. The difference between the 100 generations of the observant community and the 96, 97 generations of the guy who's out. We understand that in the concept of our past, how our neshamas work, they have a huge amount in common with us. Do we hear the idea? And now, we have a point where we can make a difference that they can't. And remember, those people we meet nowadays, almost to the 100, to a huge percentage, I mean way over 90%, they have a distance from Torah because 1 or 2 or 3 generations ago, part of their family kind of dropped out. Well, maybe they dropped part of it, and then the next generation dropped more. We have to look at the vast majority of Jews, especially the ones who are open to hearing from us, as victims of previous mistakes that they were born into. They picked the wrong great-grandparent. See the idea? Who we are, Torah was given to us to make the decision. We are the children who Torah demands to choose, make decisions like adults. We are the animals who were given the information of how to choose to be human. We are the part of a group where we can make individual decisions to make a connection to God. The vast majority of us are here because we maintain being part of a process of the Jewish people who passed down the information. And people out there, we owe it to them. And in a moment I'll see, we owe it to ourselves to make a difference to them. Now, if you were living in a world where you say, nobody's going to respond, nobody's going to answer. That was people like Reb Noach Weinberg and others who, when he started, said, nobody's interested in making change, but we live in a world where you know that there are people who are involved who are very much interested. So I'd like to lay out three basic points, little illustrations, to take into account. How many of you were involved in the Shabbos project? It was done on Parshat Noah. Sorry? To invite people over for the Shabbos. Right. The most continuous comments I've heard from the Orthodox people who've been involved is, never could imagine that something like that can make such a difference. People, how they felt the connection.
Remember, we understand that a neshama goes way beyond your consciousness, way beyond your brain. They are people who have been part of the Jewish people for 100 generations. That's the last 2 or 3 generations that didn't know about it. We have to understand that that makes a difference. Where they came from, what their past was. Just as you are here because of 100 generations of people who maintained it, and that shows an amazing spiritual genetics, they seem to be very different. They carry a 96-97% similarity. They don't have the information. That's what we're there for. So I'd like to touch on a few basic points. First of all, common understanding that people ask, a question people ask, what do I do if they ask questions? What do I do? Because, you know, a lot of Orthodoxy may feel a little uncomfortable having people over for Shabbos. What if they ask questions? First of all, you should know that the questions they ask are not going to be that difficult. But what do you do? What do you think? Somebody asks you a question, and you can't answer it. So how do you save the situation? Aren't they going to be a little strange? How come she can't answer? What? Oh, that's great. Let's look it up together. I'm going to tell you a story. I heard this from the Boston Rebbe, Oliver Shalom, Shalom LeBrocha, the one who died a few years ago. And I heard this from the person who was involved, the other character. And the stories are the same until the end. The story goes as follows. The Boston Rebbe, an outreach man for many years in Boston, somebody, a secular scholar, was told by his friends, by his Orthodox friends, oh, you have philosophical questions. The Boston Rebbe is a brilliant man. You should ask him your question. So he made an appointment, and a young man, quite a brilliant man, and after a little socializing, said, well, I'd like to hear your question. So the guy came with a list of 10 bomb kashes. How do you say bomb kashes in English? You know, bomb questions. You're like, wow. He asked his first question. The rabbi said, whoa, okay, maybe hear it. Checkmate. No answer. Okay, second one. Third. At the end of hearing all those questions, the rabbi said, you know, the one thing all these questions, amazingly abstruse questions, they all sound like the kind of question that the pre-tzaddik, one of the Reb Tzadok of Lublin, the pre-tzaddik, you know, the way he thought, let's make time, 2 times a week, we'll make a chavruta to learn pre-tzaddik. And after a while, the guy became religious. But now I have to give you the 2 different endings. The Boston Rebbe ended it by saying, and after a while he became religious, even though I couldn't answer his question. That was the Boston Rebbe's answer. The young man said, I became religious because I learned this stuff, some with him and some with others. And then he said, had the Rebbe come up with 10 good answers on the spot, I would have left there saying, this man is the greatest philosophical genius in Western civilization, and nobody even knows he exists. But I would have gone home, having not learned with him, I would have stayed secular. I ended up becoming observant because he couldn't answer, and therefore I learned. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, when somebody asks you a good question that you could answer, tell them we don't know. But I'm telling you, you lose nothing to say, let's learn. To say, I'll get in touch with others. Say, I'll look it up. Because what makes the most connection is caring for other people. And therefore, nothing, not only is nothing lost by not having the answer to their question, your ability to show, first of all, you're telling them that you are not the one from on high, the God's representative to teach you all about life. You're making a connection, you're orthodox, you don't know everything. And the opening for the person to learn. Now, I understand we all feel a little uncomfortable when we have to say, I don't know. Although all the rabbis tell us that the greatness of a scholar is when he says, I don't know. But to understand, in the experience of people who do outreach, not knowing how to answer doesn't lose a thing. If anything, it simply opens the door to continuing learning. You hear the idea. Another very important point. You can't make someone religious. If you ever hear people, well, I want to be Makarv, I want to make somebody religious. It can't be done. There's only one person who can make a Jew religious. Who's that? The person themselves. What you're doing is facilitating. We know that in the Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest Torah scholar among the Jewish people. And he had a cousin by the name of Korah. It didn't work. It didn't work. You are not out there to make somebody religious. You're out there to try to show concern and caring for somebody, to think about ideas, to open them up to ideas, let them think about things, to be a conduit into other people's lives. Let me give you, again, another story to illustrate it. My mom, Olea Shalom, I got straight thinking from my father, but from my mother, along with straight thinking, I got chutzpah. Chutzpah is my mother. Story. They lived in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. And my mom hears from other people in the grapevine that a family of Jews for Jesus moved into the neighborhood, Cleveland Heights. So my mom said, well, what are we doing about it? So I said, well, everybody, you know, the kids are yelling at them and nobody has talked to them. My mom said, that's not the way you deal with people. You gotta do outreach. So everybody says, outreach of Jews for Jesus. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So my mom looks up, finds the number, calls up the family and come up with the name of it. I don't want anything because these people are actually around. The Goldberg, that's not their name, calls up and, hi, are you the Goldberg? Says, yeah. Well, my name is Rosalind Berger, and I hear there's a nice new Jewish family in the neighborhood. I'd like to invite you for Shabbat. This is no cause of the story. This must have been 30 years ago. She had chutzpah. She didn't get scared just because of what they believe in. And so she invited him to come for Shabbat. So first, the ladies of the house found a little change. And they said, well, I want you to know we're believers. We're believers. My mom said, yeah, we are too. And my mom knew what they were talking about. But, you know what I mean? Oh, we're Orthodox, you know. No, she explains that we believe, we're Jewish, we're not Christian, we're Jewish, but we believe. You know. Mom said, well, yeah, you know, don't worry, we don't have to get into details, you know. So now, Mindy Goldberg says, oh my gosh, maybe I got a live one on. So she starts missionizing and preaching. My mom said it was Thursday, she was making the chulin. Yeah, like, listen to her, meanwhile, she'll drive. Again, I'm not trying to suggest exactly how to do this. But my mom said, yeah, meanwhile, let her talk and get friendly. And she's talking, my mom says, yeah. In the middle, my father, comes out. And my mother said to my father, you know, to the girl. Oh, hi, my husband just came in. He'd like to invite you for Shabbos, too, to my father takes the phone. And she says, I want you, we're not Christian, we're Jewish, and I'm very proud to be Jewish. She told me later, that this is what really threw her for a loop. My father said, well, it's a good thing that you're proud to be a Jew, but it's important for you to know that if any of your ancestors for the last 2,000 years had chosen to believe in Jesus, you wouldn't be a Jew. You're only Jewish because they all said no. She said, like it hit her. Said, how can she be proud of her being a Jew? And the only reason she's a Jew is because of all the people before. But that kind of shook her up a little. My mom, thinking that was a little too tough at first, takes back the phone and says, anyway, listen, don't talk. Don't we have to get... Meanwhile, you come over... And they would get together and... It's a strange, kind of bittersweet kind of story. And my mother told him, we'll have you over when we make a sukkah. Bring over the three kids. We'll show you the sukkah. In other words, I at the time was involved in anti-missionary work. And my mom's basic attitude was, listen, if my kid can do it, I could do it too. I mean, there's a little bit of chutzpah, that's all. My father died suddenly, Erev Sukkot. And so for reasons I wouldn't expect it, I ended up flying immediately for the funeral thing. I was there. And on Chol HaMoed, my mom, I didn't know anything about this. My mom said, oh my gosh, I told, I could imagine she was a little busy on other the Goldberg, I told them I'd invite them. Who are they? She tells me the story. She calls them up. They were so shocked. I mean, they felt terrible. They had just met my father. They come, and we meet, and as a result, by the end of Sukkot, they were out of Christianity. And in the end, they became involved in the Jewish community in Cleveland Heights. All because my mom, confidence. I think that's what I'm looking for. Confidence. I don't have to answer every question. You have to understand we have something important. You can make a difference. Understand that you can make a difference. Do you require siyata dishmaya? Do you require the help of God? Of course, but you require that for everything we do. Raising our families, our kids. We don't make people religious. We try to make connections. To understand that at a time when the Jewish world is actually approaching a point of no return, certain point in which those who are really distant are getting... Eish HaTorah, I've been there 30 years. In 1985, when I went there, one or two people a year would turn out to be non-Jewish, according to Halacha. Now it's a much bigger number of people who come to Eish HaTorah. And remember, these are the people who care. More and much higher percentage people come to Eish HaTorah who are not Jewish halachically. And the truth is, there's a time in which outreach is going to be, again, we have decades, but the time is coming in which there are going to be so many of them, we won't know who's Jewish and who's not, it'll kind of pull itself to a halt. We're in the last few, there are two schedules on which a Jewish community can act. Number one, when it's almost too late, and number two, when it is too late. We have to understand that it can't go on indefinitely. A Torah community, and to understand another level of confidence, by the way, in the year 1900, around the year 1900, the Jewish Encyclopedia wrote about it, in its article on conservative Judaism, actually, that the Reform movement started in the early 1800s. In the late 1800s came a conservative movement in which the basic understanding was that orthodoxy will not survive the 20th century. That the 20th century will be a secular century, and therefore, since orthodoxy will not survive, and reform is way too out, and as it will be a non-Jew, so we're going to come up with something in between. That was the general understanding in the early 1900s. Now we live in the early 2000s, where the Pew reports, the various different reports, talk about that the only one that's likely to survive is Orthodox. We have a different level of confidence. And really, kind of echoes its way through the non-Orthodox Jewish world. Rav Noach Weinberg used to point out when I first started 30 years ago that the average non-Frum Jew in the 1980s, the general attitude was, you guys have to be nuts to think this is true, but okay, I'll give you a hearing. And it's pretty clear in this, that those who are teaching Torah out there, that is no longer the case. That even as you have a high intermarriage rate, etc., the Jewish world as a whole has the attitude that, okay, look, maybe that's one way it makes perfect sense. It's a world that's much more open to hearing about it. I'll tell you how Rabbi Noach Weinberg said it. He said in the 1950s, there were not Balei Tshuva. But somewhere in the 1950s, and this is like a construct, he's not talking like he knows who it is, 10 guys did Tshuva. 10 guys became Balei Tshuva. But I'm from the Orthodox world then. I remember occasionally you'd run into Baal Tshuva, even Orthodox Jews would say, well, man, he must be nuts, you know, it was so rare. 10 guys did Tshuva. They were like the Abrahams. Like, it's like they didn't give a hoot about what anybody else said. 10 guys, what did they create? They created a situation where not only do you have 10 people who did Tshuva, but with them doing Tshuva, it created 100 people who would consider it. When those 100 did tshuva, not only did those 100 do tshuva, but it created a situation of 1,000 people saying, I could consider that possibly. It was still like an extreme example of millions of Jews in America. When 1,000 did tshuva, they identified 10,000 who could consider it. And once you had 10,000, you had hundreds of thousands who considered it. The Jewish world in America, with all of its falling out, off, and with all of its intermarriage, there isn't anyone in America who should be considered beyond the possibility of considering doing tshuva. Do you understand? It doesn't matter how far they are in Torah terms, what they're doing, but the possibility of that they could see themselves as someone who considered, that really covers the entire Jewish world, the entire American Jewry. And that your point is not to make anyone religious, it's to make the connection through whom they'll find other people, see other people. A third very important point is that very often people say the Jewish people are in danger of disappearance. If not for our hard work, the Jewish people could disappear. I get this, interestingly enough, from non-Orthodox, where a lot of kids who come to Eishet Torah say, my conservative and reform rabbi said that if we don't marry Jewish girls enough, the Jewish people will disappear. Now, I'm sure the rabbi means well, but it doesn't create a tremendously, what's the word I'm looking for? What? A tremendously positive view of a group of people who are about to go over the edge of the cliff. It's important, and so I often say to them, no, the Jewish people are eternal. But it's important for us to understand. The Jewish people are eternal. We're not here because, depending on what we do, from the time that God gave us the Torah, the Jewish people are eternal. We can make ourselves stronger, we can make ourselves weaker, but the Jewish people, their survival is a given. And do you understand, very often when the kid says, my rabbi said that if we marry Gentile girls, the Jewish people will disappear. So I ask the guy, well, your rabbi told you that, reform or conservative, did that impress you with the fact that you should marry Jewish girls? And almost all of them said no. Because he's telling me to get married to a Jewish girl for the national interest. One of the guys said, only a fascist or a Nazi gets married for the national interest. He said, and I
Marriage is a personal decision. And therefore, you understand, he's going to take the most liberal Jews, the most liberal American Jews, and you're going to tell them to marry for the national interest? You understand, it's not very appealing. So I tell the guys, I said, you're right, you're absolutely right. That's not the reason to do it. We're saying that the Jewish people is eternal. Nothing will get in the way. You know, the Jewish people, there are three basic threats to our survival. What are the three basic threats? Well, in the order of the least important, number three challenge is our enemies. Number two threat is our friends. Number one threat is ourselves. But if after all this time the Jewish people are eternal, it's in spite of all of those three problem areas. And I point out to the guys, the Jewish people are not in danger. We're an eternal people. I am not in Eishet Torah working on the survival of the Jewish people. Because if I were, he'd have a right to say, great, you want me to drop my Gentile girlfriend and to marry some Jewish girl to be one more piece of cannon fodder for Jewish survival. They're saying, no. The Jewish people are going to be around either way. What I'm telling you is that if you knew what we mean by Torah, and you understand what it means to be a Jew, you wouldn't marry a Jewish girl for Jewish survival. You'd marry because of what you want in life for yourself and your kids. And we should understand that too. We're not approaching people because of the danger of Jewish survival. The Jewish people are eternal. We're doing it to teaching people the central element of what it means to be a Jew, and really saying the Torah teaches what it means to be a human being. And to the extent that we wonder about that, I would posit that I can certainly consider for myself in my 30 years teaching at Eishet Torah, no one that has ever gone through my class has gotten as much from learning from me as I have learning from them. That to be involved in making a difference to other people and being a conduit will do for each one of you much more than you could possibly imagine. The rabbis tell us, "La'olam yomod adam Torah shelo lishma." When we talk shelo lishma balishma, that a person should always get involved in Torah for selfish reasons. For selfish reasons, and through that you'll once get it to more pure reasons. And therefore, I think it's important. By the way, this is true for all relationships: Jews with our fellow Jews, people themselves. Tom, are you married? Is your wife there, next to you? Never mind, I'm not going to do it. No, I'm just going to pick. Oi. All right. I'm not talking about Tom. Not talking about. Why, let's picture, guy's at Eishet Torah, and he gets engaged. Mazel tov, great, who's a lucky girl. And then I ask the guy, tell me, why did you marry that girl? Why do you want to marry that girl? For her good or for your good? Nobody else is around, so he can answer a lot more truthfully than Tom. What? Thanks. Brave kid. Tom got married to his wife for his good. What's your name?
Suzanne.
Suzanne decided to marry Tom for her good. Hey, you've been at a Jewish wedding? You've been at weddings there? So now you know what a wedding is. Two selfish people trying to take care of themselves. Or, as I sometimes point out to the guy, you know, nobody marries the girl because they love the girl. You marry a girl because you love yourself. And when you come to the conclusion that that girl would be great for the one you truly love. You try to get a hoodwinker into marrying you. After all, gentlemen, if you really loved her, you wouldn't have married her. You'd find some really nice guy for her. In other words, what we're saying is, okay, in other words, a person gets married because they've come to the conclusion that that woman would be great for me. And that's not yet love. That is, take care of yourself. But because he's a smart guy and he realizes that, well, I want a happy life, and a happy life requires
a
happy wife, so you put energy into her happiness because you know that the happier she is, still taking care of old number one there, right? Still taking care of Tom. But the rabbis tell us that the more energy you put into another person's life, the more you will love them. Without going into too much detail, are you energy or matter, Tom?
Yes.
Very good. And therefore, while he looks more like matter, but your essence is more the energy, we say, the soul, the cat. And therefore, the more energy you put into another person's life, the more you and they become an us. But it's called lo lishma. We start doing it. I think that guy would be good for me. You put energy into their happiness, and then what really creates love is not the initial thing saying that's good for me. It's the energy you put into the other person's happiness. Even though at first you do it because happy wife is a happy life. So to understand that in all areas, la'olam yomod adam torah shelo lishma, that people always get involved with doing the right thing for more self-interested reasons. Umitoch shelo lishma ba'al lishma. Slowly it becomes. You marry a girl because you think it's good for you. Only your work is good for him. You put energy in. And really, that giving is what creates the love. But it's always worth it early on to understand the value, the self-interest, right? You did your research. You want to find out about her. Find out how it is good for you. So I'd like to end on an interesting Hasidic note. There's a concept, I wasn't Hasidus and Musar, that everything in the world can teaches us about, everything in the world teaches us about connection to God. Have you ever familiar that when they had telegraph, when they first came out with telegraph, tells you that every word is charged for. A telephone teaches what you say here will be heard far, far away. Right? Nowadays, can you imagine? Computers, every piece of information can be stored. Everything in the world teaches us. This goes further and says, even destructive things can be used to understand life. For example, what do you learn from atheism? You learn from atheism the idea that when a Jew comes to you for help, don't tell him, pray. First, act as if there is no God and do what you can to help him. Then, when you go as far as you can to help him, now let's talk about Davin, right? To help. So I'd like to talk about this. What value is there of Galut? We're in Galut. The Jewish people are powerless. And the guys with the army, we're powerless. The guys with the army are in Israel are even more trouble than we are. What is the value of Galut? And their answer is like this. The mashal that was given by this rabbi. Example, there's a kingdom where the king is a wonderful man. He cares about his subject, works both day and night. And he has wonderful laws to keep the kingdom running well. One of the laws is that only the top brilliant people in the kingdom can come see the king because, you know, even in a democracy, everybody can just walk into to the White House and see the president. So the top people can see the king, and if you're not there, you see the princes, the governors, because of the honor of the kingdom. And in that way, the kingdom is run very efficiently and the best for the citizens. One day, a group of evil rebels capture the capital, and they take over. And they want to kill the king. But the king escaped, and because his people loved him so much,
they hid him away from these people. They put him through the forest. They gave him the best food that they could give. It wasn't the kind of food a king would eat, but it was the best food that they could afford. They gave him their beds to sleep in. They gave him their clothes. The clothes were real itchy with peasant clothes. It was the best they can. And that way they kept the king alive till the loyalist forces regrouped, counterattacked, took over the capital, smashed the rebels, and the kingdom was once again put in the hands of the king. And there was a great day in which the king would come back to the capital and he trumpets and announce the king is back in place. And the king announced that all the old laws, the laws that were best for all the kingdom, are put back in place, including the laws which said that only the top people can come and see the king, because the king has to be efficient about his time. But at this point, once the kingdom was renewed and restored, an exception was made. Any of the peasants who put himself out for the kingdom, who kept the king alive, it wasn't food that agreed with his stomach, but it did the best. They gave him their beds, gave him their homes, gave him their clothes. Anybody who put himself out, maintained the kingdom until things were restored, they earned a special connection to the king. They're a special group, and they can always come to the king's house at any time. Ladies and gentlemen, the Jewish people are in exile. We need a lot of help. The time is coming. We call the Messianic Age, coming of Mashiach, when things will be set aright. And at that point, everything is going to be put in place. But the Rebbe said, but the great advantage to exile is that when the Jewish people are needy, when there's trouble, then even us peasants, who otherwise would never earn such an amazing connection to God. But that's the great opportunity for us. When the kingdom is in trouble and they need us peasants, we have a capacity for earning a connection to God that in better times we could never hope for. The kingdom is in trouble, needs a lot of help. There are Jews out there. We don't have to be rabbis. We don't have to be great scholars. There are people out there who need help, and we can make a difference. We already see that every time we try that, we have tremendously positive response. We should understand, even just for ourselves, that reaching out to other Jews is a tremendous opportunity. It's an opportunity we shouldn't miss. And thank you very much. Any questions? Questions, statements, ideas came up? Questions. Yes?
Is Eisha anything about the division between the religious and non-religious in Israel?
Eisha Torah, we have different elements of dealing with that. We have people in the building. We do what we can. We have programs, different times of the year. Pesach, we have Rosh Hashanah, now we're going to have Hanukkah, where we have musical groups and skits tour guides who bring people through who are not observant but who want to be in Jerusalem. Hanukkah is a special time for that. And try to make a difference. Unfortunately, the problem in Israel is much more. You're absolutely right, it should be done. In Israel, it's a little more severe because here there's no politics involved. Now, here, all it is trying to make connections. In Israel, because of the political nature of things, so there are a lot of secular Jews who are more resistant because they are told by their side that they're only doing it to get more votes for their parties in the election. So we're trying to, but there's much more resistance there. Again, so you're right, it should be done, but it's a whole different thing because of the idea that which party are you doing this for? We're not doing about, you know, who would you want me to vote for? The politicization is a major issue. Yeah.
Weinberger's program for about, it was like a 12-hour program for yeshiva fellows. Does that program still go on, where you bring in a group of guys that are in yeshiva already that need to be...
You mean once a week stuff?
So we came in and he just drilled us for like 12 hours, the fail safe and the whole thing is a great program.
Oh, the discovery one.
Yeah.
So now we do, I have for the yeshiva guys, American yeshiva guys in Israel, Saturday night, every Saturday night we do ongoing. Like going through the basics of Judaism, how to teach it, the practical application, you know, our concept of what, you know, according to Torah, you know, what is anti-Semitism, what is who is a Jew, on the different levels for yeshiva guys to be able to know. I don't think that in secular terms, remember, what's your name, first name?
Ruben.
So I would say, you know, that's why I said you're both a child and an adult. Ruben, every religious Jew is both religious and secular. Because we think with two different parts of our brain. So the secular side says, well, you want the people who have the max amount of time, they'll be involved. I think in religious terms, we can't make the difference. That a Jew, at any point of their life, who does a mitzvah changes the Jewish people. At any point, any Jew does a mitzvah in their life, it changes the Jewish people. And if the younger person who you affect may be there for longer, frankly, I think the more mature person is more who's interested in hearing, can't just drag somebody in, is going to be more mature about settling down and figuring out, okay, what's it all about. So I'm willing to hear from you about that, but I don't see that we should have any type of age range of yes and no. Does that make sense to you?
I work with a lot of high school kids, so we say to myself, at this point in their life, they can't necessarily make those changes that we speak of, and therefore, even from the college campus, even when they're in their freshman, sophomore years, it's not as good as when they're in their graduate years. But if you start picking and choosing, you lose those opportunities, even if they're not, as they're not inclined to be able to make changes in their life right now, but they still could die to, to expose them, to bring them in, to try, even though they're not necessarily going to follow up or make those decisions to change in their life. I understand everything you're saying, but at any point in a person's life, that change can be effective body as well.
Yeah, well, one of the most, two of the most effective elements of Eisha Torah now is JWRP, Jewish Women's Renewal Program, in which they aim for women in their 40s, kids who are teens and upper teens, as the best one, and they, Baruch Hashem, they're able to get many people. They're so good that they have a JWR, Jewish Women's Renewal Program, men's division, where the women end up roping in their husbands to come for a men's program. That's probably the best way to do it, I think. And then we have Eisha Torah has a thing called a Project Inspire, which is based in New York, but has a lot of material, a tremendous amount of material that is the people who run the Rabbi Chaim Samson and a Simcha Barnett. I think that projectinspire.com, where also they have tools, ideas, like how to have, page after page of how to have people over Shabbos, how to invite, what comes up, the do's and don'ts and things like that. And they're very good material. And Project Inspire of Eisha Torah is a very good source for finding out, for people who want to know, answer to certain questions about how to do it. And I've checked back with them. They've been doing it for quite a few years now, and not one person has been punched in the nose for asking a Jew, inviting a Jew over for Shabbos. See, you know, we none of us want to be failures. So the one way to not have somebody say something nasty when you invite them over for Shabbos is to not ask them. But it's almost unheard of that such a thing happens. People say, oh, I can't. No, but I really appreciate that. That's the way people are. Nobody ever got punched in Gesundheit. Gesundheit. Nobody. We don't like being failures. And the way to, you know, the way to avoid a girl saying no to you is never asking one. I mean, like, not a good idea. Anyone else out here? Tom! Look, it is a great difficulty. Because what we really are saying is that 50 years ago, 100 years ago, the difference between the Torah view of life and the Gentile view of life was like, this was the Gentile understanding of public morality, and this was the Torah understanding, and you have to explain this gap to somebody who said, why be Torah observant? The world around us has collapsed. That's the way we feel. And therefore, you have a much bigger gap. Let me give you two examples. And all I can say is, you're right, Tom. We have to deal with the fact that that world is very different than it used to be. So at Eisha Torah, I once had a... Not too long ago, it was half a year. A guy came by, you know, all different types of people come to Eisha Torah, and in a question and answer, this young Reform rabbi who was studying the refresher courses at, you know, the Reform place, and a very nice guy, he did not mean it. He said, can you explain what you Orthodox have against gay marriage? So I'll tell you what came up at the time. I'm not saying this is the answer. No. Another time I may have said something else. I said, I'm not going to answer that question, but I'd like to explain why I'm not going to. You're asking, what do you have against gay marriage? So what I'd like to ask you in return, prove I'm Jewish, let's see. Supposing we were in the year 1950. He was a knowledgeable young man. Suppose you're you and I'm I, but it's 1950. And I said to you the following. If you, Reform, you don't believe in a God-given Torah. You believe the Torah is man-made. If that's so, then what would prevent you? Here we are in 1950. What would prevent you from doing marrying a man to another man for the purpose of a sexual relationship? What would you have said in 1950? Would you have said, why not? Or would you have said, that's the sickest thing I ever heard, and I can't believe that you Orthodox would ever be so horrible as to believe that because we're not like you, we would ever do something like that? Which of those two answers would you give me in 1950? And he said, probably the latter. And therefore, my question to you is, as an otherwise intelligent group, why is it that from 1820, till the Gentiles who said it's a wonderful thing, you didn't think about it either. You have a mind of your own. Why didn't the Reform movement come up with it if it made that much sense? So I'm going to ask you a different question now. Again, it was in my turf. He was at Eish HaTorah, and it was a decent fellow. So I'm going to ask you a different question now. Supposing I ask you the following question, and there were about 25 people in the room. It's the year 2014 now. And I say to you, if you don't believe God gave the Torah, and therefore what Torah talks about has nothing to do with what God wants, because it's just a bunch of Jews making it up, what would prevent you from doing a marriage between a man and his German shepherd for the sake of a sexual relationship? My guess is you would say that's the sickest thing I ever heard, and that I can't believe you would think we would do it. But I would posit to the 25 people in this room that if for whatever crazy reason, 40 years from now, it is done, we all know that you would be doing it too. And therefore, my question is not why, it's how do you make your decisions? Do you have any aspect of yourself as an individual Jew or as a human being other than whatever is going on out there? Because I know that the question we Jews ask is, how could the German of the 1920s, who was so open-minded and liberal and accepting of Jews, how could they have gone for the Nazis in the 1930s? It wasn't like 100 years later. The answer is clear. Because in a world where people don't have a mind of their own, they are whatever the world around them tells them to be. It was the same people. It wasn't three generations later. And the answer is because when the world tells them this is right, and when the world tells them that is right. I'd have to get involved with you to discuss what's a human soul, what's a human being versus an animal, what is male versus female, et cetera, et cetera. I'd have to get into the deepest level of what's a soul. But I'm asking you, how do you make decisions? Other than checking with the people around you as to what is expected of you now. I could respect a Reform movement who does gay marriage. I'd respect them more if they did it 50 years before the Gentiles did it. But if, as long as the Gentiles don't do it, they say no also, what's there to respect? And if you would have come up with women rabbis before the Christians coming up with women clergy rather than after, I'd say, I think you're mistaken. You don't have a Torah concept of the polar, what is the difference between a male and a female, but I can respect the fact that you have ideals. But if in fact all you do is check with the Gentiles as to when you make changes, I can't respect you for it either. Another thing is that I, just on this trip, you know, I have a list of 600, I send out my emails to a whole list of people who had ever made it on my list. One of them, my son, Mendy's yeshiva boy, well, he's 40 years old, you know, he had friends and thing, and they've been working for the last, you know, almost 20 years, and his friends really hang along together. And it's amazing that 20 years, they still have new episodes that would fit on TV. And one of them is that one of his friends, married and with kids, just came out of the closet and divorced his wife, and he has his own home and he has a friend he's with, and he's trying to be gay, observant. I mean, he still believes in it, so when I sent out I know this has been going on for about 2 years with my son's friend. And on this trip I sent out a few months ago to my mailing list, and he said, Rabbi Berger, I'd like to issue a bit of a challenge. I have a group of people, some of whom are from, some were from, some never were, and we do Jewish stuff together. Because I personally try to keep as much of the Torah as I can as an Orthodox Jew. And I would like you to talk to the group. Now, for reasons I won't go into, internal Eisha Torah, whatever, Eisha Torah does not have a Rosh Yeshiva now. And I guess I took advantage of that situation for saying I would do it. And I met with them. So I just would want to say, Tom, that they didn't require me agreeing with stuff. They just wanted me to talk to them. And I feel the situation is tough, tragic. I can't tell you what other words I can say about it. But, first we're talking about general Jewish stuff on my general categories, and then their questions were around their own lives. I just want to say this, I'm not lobbying for them, but he said, the worst thing the gay world has is that they're referred to as sexual preference. Preference sounds like, well, I think I would like this better than that. It's not preference. It feels very much just locked into that. I can't tell. They were the nicest people in terms of thanking me to talk to them. Now, I'm not saying they're all like that, but I'm saying there has to be, just like when we deal with non-frum people, there has to be maintain the tension between disagreeing and caring about Jews. I can't think of any area of Jewish life that would be more dissonant with Torah Judaism. But, at Eishet Torah for 30 years, what I find most is trying to preserve the balance. At Eishet Torah, we have people coming with non-Jewish wives, in which we don't do the weddings, and we don't, but if they want to learn Torah, we learn. So, I think that you don't have to come up with agreement in order to care about another Jew. Am I making any sense to you, Tom? And Reb Noach Weinberg always said that we're not here to make Jews frum. We're here that in the world where nobody's perfect, there are only two directions a Jew is heading. Life is a dynamic. A person's either heading away from observance of Torah or into observance of Torah. And you just want to help people to head in the right direction. It's not your business. Everybody will make their own decision. They may never keep Shabbos, and you may never stop speaking Lashon Hara. Most important thing is to try to get people to head in rather than out. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Berger, for your insightful and inspiring talk, and thank you everybody for coming and joining us. A special thank you to Tom.
For sure.
And a good evening to all. Thank you.
There's 10 people that want to announce Meyer.